Welcome to this podcast from the Argyllshire Advertiser. We recorded this programme live at the general election hustings event organised by the young people at Time for Change Argyll at Lochilpedge Joint Campus on Monday, December the 2nd, 2019, from beginning to end. The hustings, which had an environmental and climate change theme, was chaired by Philip Price, and all four Argyll and Bute candidates attended. Rhea Barnes, Labour, Gary Mulvaney, Conservative, Brendan O'Hara, SNP, and Alan Reid, Lib Dem. This podcast is split into two parts because of its length.
Hello. Can everyone hear me okay?
Yes.
Yeah? Excellent. Thank you so much for all of you turning up. And the organisers were really excited about this opportunity to see so many people here. It means it actually works and we can try and get some good questions across these four candidates here. So thank you very much. Just to give you a little bit of background of where tonight's come from and who everyone is, Time for Change are a youth group that are concerned about the environment, and they decided to create this hustings to concentrate on only environmental issues. So this questioning, these policies that we've been discussing are only to do with the environment today. So no use of the B word, please. So to give you my background, I'm a wildlife guide and tour operator here in Argyll, and I've been involved in many different environmental organisations over the last 10 to 15 years. So I've been well embedded in local environmental issues, and in the last couple of years I've sort of put my head up a little bit and started thinking more on a national scale. So this is where my background comes from. So in terms of the chair, I am absolutely biased. I think environmental issues are the greatest issue of our time, and I don't think it's been given enough importance in the national debate. I think one hour TV debate isn't enough. So this is why I think it's a really, really good idea. I've got full support for the other folks that put this on. So to introduce, so first of all, thank you very much for everybody turning up. I was unknown when you come to these things, and it means a lot to all of us that you're here giving up your time for this. So thank you very, very much. Who we've got here today, we've got Brendan O'Hara from SNP on the far right there. We've got Alan Lee from the Liberal Democrats sitting on the middle right there. And we have Rhea Barnes from Labour, who's near me here. And we've got Gary Mulvaney, who is from the Conservatives there. Okay? When we do questions, you can ask individual questions to a particular party, or you can ask a general question and I'll give them a couple of minutes each to answer. So you can do either one of those two things, and we'll try and be fair that everyone gets a few questions. Just to put things in context a little bit, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that carbon makes the planet warmer. We all know that. I think we're now at the point where, in fact, there was a report just recently about tipping points. We're now at the tipping point. We need to fix this stuff. We need to stop the planet going above 2 degrees. It's not an if or maybe or if we could do if we sort all this stuff out. It's an absolute essential. And the only way to do that is to reduce our carbon emissions and also to rebuild our ecosystems. And these are the two things we're going to concentrate on tonight. Reducing our carbon emissions and rebuilding our ecosystems. Because on the one hand, it stops a problem. On the other hand, it helps us mitigate the problems we already have. If we have forests, if we have keystone species back in our ecosystems, if we have barriers to flooding, high winds, storms, this will help mitigate against some of the things we're going to see no matter what we do with our carbon. So these are the two main key drivers of tonight's questions that I think we'll try and stick to. And just before we start, I want to say to a few people earlier, one of the thing I think I'd like to see the debate move on from is guilt. Yeah, we've all got to do a bit, and I get that, but this isn't about making people feel guilty for their choices. This is about moving forward as a society. And actually, and this is where it gets really exciting, the future could be amazing if we achieve this. We could have free energy virtually if we go down renewables. We could all have warm homes. We need to worry about heating your homes again if they're all insulated correctly. We could have an ecosystem where you can go out at Crinan and see great whales on a regular basis. And the industry and the tourism that comes from that. The future could be seriously exciting. This isn't doom and gloom, this is an opportunity. And what I'm really interested in to see is if they buy because that's up to these guys. Okay? So what I'm going to do to begin with is I'm going to let each of them talk for about 5 minutes in terms of their own environmental policies and where their party's coming from. So we'll just start off with Mia on the left here and then work on from there.
Hello everyone. Good evening and thank you for attending this evening. It's wonderful to see so many people engaging with the political process. The time to act is now. I would say we are on the precipice of an environmental disaster, but we are over it. The climate collapse is here. It's the greatest challenge facing the future of our area, country and planet. We must act now. On the 1st of May 2019, the UK Parliament was the first in the world to declare a climate and environmental emergency. This is a good start, but it does not go far enough. For too long, politicians have sat and done very little. Words are not good enough. We need real action. For me, Argyll Butte is one of the most beautiful places in the world, and our communities and industry are inextricably linked to the land. And whether that be fishing, farming, forestry, land management, renewables or tourism, we need our land and it needs us. Although our LFU's carbon footprint is relatively small, we are at the mercy of the actions of our neighbours, domestic and foreign. Domestically, the Tories have failed to take any real action to tackle this crisis, choosing instead to cut subsidies for renewables and side with big industry and fracking companies. An example of this was when Boris Johnson announced a moratorium on fracking, which, as we pointed out, was a temporary commitment, not a plan. He also gave the go-ahead for a new deep coal mine in Cumbria, which was slipped past with much little fanfare. Closer to home, while we all reuse, recycle and work towards a net zero waste lifestyle, big corporations are running rampant in Scotland with false promises of cleaning up their act. The six big polluters, the petrochemical giant Ineos, Shell, ExxonMobil, Raytheon, GlaxoSmithKline and Texas Instruments do little of anything to reduce their impact. Abroad, countries like China and India push forward with damaging industrial revolutions, willfully oblivious of the consequences. And in America, Donald Trump seals himself in a little bubble of denial of what the world burns. I do not come here to bring tidings of doom and gloom. Things can and will change. Labour is ready poised to unleash a green revolution like the world has never seen. We will invest nearly £10 billion over the next 10 years to restore nature, adopting natural solutions to climate change, recovering our island's biodiversity, reducing waste and protecting valuable habitats and species both on land and in the seas around us. Our new Green Deal will decarbonise the UK through a radical policy package to increase social and economic justice. We will aim for net zero emissions by 2030, establish a national climate service and will act as a world leader on climate change. Our policies on renewable energy will transform that sector and bring plenty of highly skilled jobs for life, which our communities so desperately need. This is but a taste of the green revolution we could unleash, and I am ready for it. Real change can happen, and another world is possible, one we don't have to fear for our future. Labour will be the one to deliver it, and when I read the manifesto, full to the breath of green progressive proposals, it gives me hope. Hope that I can see positive change for our communities and our environment, and I urge you to look it too. Thank you.
Thank you, Rhea. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm delighted to be here in Lochgilphead today. And it's nice that probably the B word or the I word may not be mentioned in this debate, but we'll see how long that lasts. I think a few things are as urgent to us as tackling the climate emergency and preventing the disastrous consequences that affect people across the world. You've only got to look at the fires that we've seen in California or Australia. You've got to look at the drought that we've seen in South Africa and Zimbabwe. You know, even the floods that we've seen so recently in the UK, down in Yorkshire, to understand that the time to act is now. In terms of what a Conservative majority government will do, let me just run through some of the things that we have done, some of the things that we propose to do. First of all, we want to have legally binding targets by 2050 in terms of a carbon zero policy. In Scotland, we supported an amendment to the recent legislation in terms of making that 2045. And you know, the good thing in terms of the UK is we have reduced greenhouse gases by over a quarter since 2010. So we are making progress, but agreeably we need to actually make much more progress. One of the things that we do need to do is, as a developed country, an industrial country, is to look after the poorer countries. And that's one thing that I take great pride in what the UK does abroad. We're a world leader in terms of providing funds to those developing countries to change and to be able to go greener. And one of the things that we're doing over the next 5 years, if we are returned to government, is doubling that budget to over £11 billion, which I think is a sign of our commitment that it's not only up to us to fix the problem, it's up to others in the world to fix the problem, but we do need to actually give them their help. Now, of course, next year, the UK government has brought the World Climate Change Conference to Glasgow. We'll have over 200 world leaders there. And I would be delighted to be your MP and have some of the members of your organisation, Time for Change, here in Argyllshire, along to that event and make sure that everybody understands, you know, all our collective positions. I think that the one thing that needs to be emphasised with all of us is it'll only happen by us together doing action. So it'll only happen if we in Argyll and Bute do things, we in Scotland do things, we in the United Kingdom do things, and we need to work with other foreign countries and internationally, because there's no point in us doing our part here in Argyll or in Scotland or in the UK or in Europe if other parts of the world are not able to do the same, because the end result will be not a positive one. So I would end my short presentation by just saying that the Conservatives are very much focused on a green revolution. We have made progress in the past. We have got plans to do that in the future. But it is down to us together to actually make these things work.
Good evening, and I want to first of all thank Time for Change Argyll for organising tonight's hustings, and thank you all for coming to hear us tonight and to take part in the discussion. I think we're all agreed that the biggest challenge the world faces is the climate crisis. We are the last generation that can stop irreversible climate change. There is no planet B. We have to act. That means we all have to do our part as individuals in recycling as much as we can, in creating as few carbon and other greenhouse gas emissions as we can. But we can't all do it on our own as individuals. It needs collective action, it needs government action, it needs international action. And this should be the main focus of the next government. Instead of the country spending all our time and energy endlessly discussing Brexit and independence, we should put those issues behind us, stay in the UK and the EU, and work with the rest of the UK and our European partners to concentrate on combating climate change. We need to work with our European neighbours. We also need to work internationally. We need international action in order to regulate the big giant private companies and to create markets for climate-friendly products, and also to help developing countries decarbonise their economies. We can create a different future, a bright future, where people breathe clean air, drink clean water, and use clean energy, where communities and industry live in harmony with nature, not at its expense. And we've got a programme to deal with that. We need an emergency programme to insulate all Britain's homes by 2030, cutting emissions and fuel bills and ending fuel poverty. We need to invest in renewable power so that at least 80% of Britain's electricity is generated from renewables by 2030. We will protect nature and the countryside to tackle biodiversity loss, and we will plant 60 million trees a year to absorb carbon, protect wildlife, and improve health. We also need to restore peatland, heathland, wetland to its natural state, as well as absorbing carbon, and that also reduces the risk of flooding. There needs to be a massive investment in public transport, electrifying all of Britain's railways, and ensuring that all new cars are driven by electric power by 2030, and that electricity coming from renewables. There also needs to be a widespread infrastructure of charging points throughout the country. We also need to bring super-fast broadband everywhere to cut down the need to travel for business. The climate and environmental implications of all national infrastructure decisions must be taken into account. We'll need to work together with UK government, national government, local councils, businesses, communities, households to make progress towards the objective of net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2045 at the latest. We'll require all companies registered in the UK to set targets consistent with the Paris Agreement on climate change and to report on their implementation and establish a general corporate duty of care for the environment and human rights. Pension funds need to be regulated so that managers have to show that their portfolio investments are consistent with the Paris Agreement, and creating new power for regulators to act if banks and other investors are not managing climate risks properly. Reuse, repair, recycle is an excellent piece of advice, but the government has a role to play in this and giving consumers and businesses the means to implement this. We will benefit consumers through better product design for repairability, reuse, recycling, and we will extend the forthcoming EU right to repair legislation so that we can help small repair business and community groups combat planned obsolescence. We must do away with any non-recyclable single-use plastics and replace them with an affordable alternative. Sustainability must lie at the heart of farming and fisheries policy. We need to rebuild depleted fish stocks to achieve their former abundance. We do face climate catastrophe, but by taking the measures I've outlined, we can avoid it and build a clean and sustainable planet for future generations. Britain was the birthplace of the Industrial Revolution. We must ensure that we are at the heart of the new Green Revolution.
Thank you to your Time for Change and to yourselves for coming out this evening. It is absolutely undeniable that we are in the middle of a worldwide climate emergency. It is without doubt the biggest threat to our civilisation. The report from Oxfam today, which shows that 20 million people across the world have had to flee their homes because of this climate emergency in the last decade, should bring that home to us. One person every 2 seconds is forced from their home because of drought or flood across the world. And as we have seen so often in the history of the world, that it is those who are least responsible who have paid the biggest price for it. And there are refugees fleeing the equator as we speak from lands which are no longer habitable simply because of climate change. So this is a global crisis, and it needs a global response. And while I'm happy that world leaders are meeting today in Madrid for the summit, the fact that Donald Trump isn't there is as predictable as it is disappointing. Trump appalled the world when he pulled out of the Paris Climate Agreement, and thanks to the likes of him and Bolsonaro, those arguments that we made and we thought we'd won decades ago about person-made contribution to global warming, we find ourselves having to make now to a whole new generation. We all have to make those arguments because we all have a responsibility. This is not one of those things that can be left to others. We cannot abdicate our responsibility for this. Governments, local authorities, communities and individuals have to act before it is too late. And I would implore you never to lose faith, particularly the young people here today, never lose faith in the power of the individual to make great changes. I said this when I joined the Oban High School climate change protest, their morning strike last Friday. It is vitally important that you never lose that faith you have in yourself to make changes. And if you want to look at an example, look at Greta Thunberg, who this time last year was barely known beyond her own front door, and now there's not a village or town in the world that hasn't heard and listened to what Greta Thunberg has to say. And I'm pleased that the Scottish Government is making moves. I don't think any government is doing enough, but I am pleased that they have set themselves pretty challenging and tough climate targets, some of the toughest in the world. You know, 75% reduction of emissions by 2030, 90% reduction by 2040, and net zero by 2045. And as Gary says, the 45 target is 5 years ahead of the UK, and I hope that the UK government look at what the Scottish government's targets are and follow suit. We need a green energy deal to secure long-term investment in clean, renewable wind, wave and tidal power. We need to harness what we have here in Argyll and Bute, and here we have an abundance of wind and water. Whether it's onshore wind, offshore wind, wave or tidal power, we have an endless supply here on our doorstep. And I think with the right investment and creating the right conditions, then Scotland and the west of Scotland can be at the forefront of the next energy revolution. And I hope that this time, as opposed to the last time, that all of society benefits from what it brings. And I welcome the First Minister's recent announcement to set aside over £1 billion to help that transition away from an oil and gas-based economy. And I wish it very well indeed, because I don't just wish it well, it has to happen. But the major problem that I think we have is that the energy policy is still reserved to Westminster. And major policy decisions are taken in London by a government who are still enthralled to the nuclear industry. Despite the astronomical cost of nuclear energy, which after September's energy auction, where offshore wind was shown to be as cheap as £39 per megawatt hour, they're still committed to be paying Hinkley C's £92.50 per megawatt hour. And of course, this was a government who, until very recently, were devotees of fracking as well. And this is the same government who, and I was there when she did it, when Amber Rudd stood up and cut the subsidy for onshore wind. Onshore wind have a devastating effect on the economy of Argyll and Bute and our ambition to reach that carbon neutral target. And I would say to you, it is inconceivable that a Scottish government would have taken such a decision. But that's what happens when your strategic energy policy is in the hands of people whose commitment to a greener, cleaner future is very suspect, to say the least. And they're not alone in that. I remember last January I spent time on the tidal barge that sat under the Cornwall Bridge, and I was there at high peak flow, and I saw the amount of energy that was being created from that one small tidal barge. That tidal barge is now in Halifax, Nova Scotia, because the UK government would not put the funds in place to allow proper investment and tidal research and tidal energy, and they wouldn't even consider allowing tax breaks to allow people to invest in what should be one of the greatest natural resources that we have. As everyone says, we have to change, we must change. There is no option not to change. But I think, as the Chair said at the beginning, change can be an opportunity, and we've got to look at it as being an opportunity to have a greener, cleaner, healthier environment for us, our children and our grandchildren. We have to accept it won't be easy, and a lot of the changes will entail hardship, some of which we may not even yet have considered. And it may be inconvenient, and it may be painful, but it will be nearly as painful if we decide to do nothing. Doing nothing is not an option. And we have to, governments, local authorities, communities and individuals, we have to get that common plan, because the planet deserves it. The planet needs it.
you very much. I hope we've got a nice outline where it is at the moment. So what I'm going to do, we'll start with one question from Time for Change, and then we'll take a question from the floor, okay? So the first question is to do with the oil industry in the UK. And within the UK, we are committed to finding ways to use less fossil fuels while offsetting emissions that we cannot avoid. Only 10.5% of Scottish oil and gas is used in Scotland, and we export 87% to other nations. So, first of all, will that calculation ever be made that we are responsible for the emissions, or that will always be passed over to whoever we export it to? And second of all, will we ever consider, or will you ever consider, not extracting oil from the North Sea oil fields and shutting them down? And if so, when would you?
I'll take that one. I think there is a commitment from the Scottish Government that a commitment and a recognition that we cannot go on simply exploring and extracting fossil fuels. Now, you cannot turn the tap off overnight. People depend on it for their heating, people depend on it for travel, you know. But there has to be a commitment to move away from it. And that's why I said earlier on that I think it's encouraging, if nothing else, that they've set aside just over £1 billion in order to have that transition away from oil and gas. And I may be wrong here, but the figure, the date that I was heard, the plan date was 2050 in order to move away from the extraction of oil and gas. And I think that's realistic. It may not be quick enough for some, but I think we have got to be judicious in our approach to it.
Will that include exports then? Will it feed the move away from extraction?
I'll be absolutely honest with you, I had never considered the question of whose responsibility would it be once you export oil to them. Is that an our emission, is it their emission? And so yeah, it's certainly food for thought.
Certainly one of the aspects of oil and gas is, in the UK, and I suppose primarily in the North East, you've got 100,000 jobs. So it's not just easy to sort of flick a switch over a very short period of time and move away from, the extraction of fossil fuels. It needs to be done in a sensible way, because, we can't, in my view, we certainly cannot make ourselves poorer by diminishing those jobs. So I think we need to do that sensibly. And I think when we've set out the target in terms of Scotland, which is 2045, which we agree with the government on, that seems a sensible way to do that. I think one of the other things that the Conservative government is looking to do is look at the whole aspect of carbon capture technology. And I think potentially the North Sea can actually play a part in that, and certainly the government and its manifesto have certainly set aside just under £1 billion to do that. That's obviously new technology in terms of carbon capture, but that's maybe a way that we can retain some of those jobs. As we move away from extraction, we can move to carbon capture and potentially hold on to some of those jobs. Because 100,000 jobs is certainly not something that any economy can certainly just afford to lose in a very, very short period of time. I mean, in terms of the issue about whose responsibility, whether it is the importer or the exporter, I'm going to say, as Brendan, it's not an issue I've ever actually thought of. And I think you could probably make a strong argument for both the exporter being responsible, so you stop it at source. I think that's probably a more logical way. Whereas there seemed to be a disincentive potentially for the importer to do it. But I think it's an interesting argument.
Yeah, we obviously need to phase out the use of oil, but we couldn't stop using it tomorrow. So it has to be phased in a planned way. We aim, as I said in the speech, and we all seem to be in agreement on this, to reach net zero carbon emissions by 2045, so that would have to be factored into the point at which we would stop extracting any more oil. As regards the question of which country does it get allocated against, the country that uses it, or the country that originally takes it out of the ground. I think in my view, the logical country is the country that actually burns it, is the country that it should be allocated against. Because it would be very unfair if a small country was exporting a lot of oil, that other countries could import it, burn it, but it was then the carbon emissions were allocated against the country where it came from. So I think the most logical is to allocate it against the country that uses it. But certainly it must be, use of oil must be phased out in a planned way.
I think we do have to phase out our reliance on oil, but I have to say that I actually agree with Alan, we can't just switch it off tomorrow. That would be short-sighted, as you know, unfortunately we do rely on it and we do rely on the money that comes from export. However, Labour is proposing a green transformation fund of $250 billion to put into renewables, so we are moving in that direction. We also have proposed an £11 billion tax on oil as well, which will help pay the cost of the climate emergency, as well as like putting in the defences we need as well, so we've not been after that. We're also supporting the decarbonisation of intense energy industries like the oil industry through using carbon capture and storage and hydrogen and energy efficiency as well. In terms of your question as who's responsible, it's a really interesting question, and like the others, it's not something I actually considered before today. But if I'm thinking, if it's my own personal opinion, I think it's the country that digs it up and sells it, because at the end of the day, you know, it's easy to pass the buck, isn't it, to say, well, it's them that's burning it, it's not our, you know, our hands are clean. But no, we're digging it up, we're providing it. If the supply wasn't there, then people wouldn't be burning it. I feel like we need to take responsibility for the consequences of that as well. Thank you.
Right.
I think what the question's about is that somebody has to legislate for
it. Yes,
so you need to allocate responsibility, yeah. So you can say, well, this country's worked for it, so we're not going to dig it up, and we need to put legislation in place to do that. I think that's where it's coming from.
See,
well,
I thought this, could I just ask
the
candidate something? It's about Hunterston. There's all this talk about renewable energy at the moment, and Scotland is doing really well on the renewable front. There's talk of them bringing Hunterston back from cracks and all, and putting it back in action. And I'd just like to see what the response is to that.
Sure.
Whether they see that.
Could you slide a little bit on Sue Mowing? What is that? A power station?
Nuclear power station.
Where is it based?
I think what I heard was that it was to to power houses down south, and actually did quite well with renewables.
Okay.
EDF. EDF.
Electricity de France.
So I think the question is, has anyone heard about this nuclear power plant?
Scotland is in a fortunate position where we can generate all our electricity from renewables. Therefore, I don't see any need to continue with Hunterston after it's reached the end of its natural life.
Certainly, I'm not aware of Hunterston. I mean, I certainly know that Torness, which is on the east coast, outside Harrington, it's had its operating life, I think, extended on at least two or three occasions. I mean, I think it's all about mix just now. Until we can actually increase the mix of recyclables and green energy, then I think you'll probably still need nuclear somewhere in that mix. I think the economic round about new nuclear power stations are slightly more challenging, But I would like to think that we'll be able to move away from nuclear. But ultimately, you know, the key thing is we all want the lights to go on. And I think that's there's still a challenge round about some of the wind power generation that we need to just make sure that we always have that continuous supply. So as much as you know we're you know keen to move to green energy, we do need to keep that at the back of our minds. Is that you know people expect you know the lights to remain on and us to have a constant supply of electricity. So there is a challenge there. You know, it's not a theoretical model we're looking at. It's a real world.
Hunterston, that was one with the crack reactor, wasn't it? Yeah, but it doesn't make me feel very safe. And we've seen what happened with the Fukushima plant as well, and all the consequences that came with that. Honestly, I'm not sure in regards to what my party's policy is with Hunterston, but I can find out for you if you'd like. But I know that we will be still using nuclear energy if we are elected, but we'll be moving away from it, I think, as you say, it's right now we need to keep the lights on, but the thought is that we're going to move towards renewables, so hopefully that will replace that in the future. Thank you.
Scotland doesn't need nuclear power. It absolutely doesn't. I mean, with the limited wind resource we currently have, in the first half of 2019, Scotland produced enough wind energy to power every house in Scotland twice over. We are exporting electricity out of Scotland, renewable, clean, green wind power electricity. And while I take Gary's point about the predictability of wind, what you don't have with tidal power is that predictability. You know exactly what tidal's going to do. It's been doing it for, since the planet was created, the tide has been flowing in and out. And you can capture that. And you know exactly when you can get it at full peak. If the technology is there, you can store that energy and you can use that energy. And if you look at the cost that this UK government is sinking into Hinkley, it's an eye-watering amount. If you look at the amount of money that they have agreed to pay per kilowatt hour, it's absolutely astonishing. Astronomical amounts of money. We don't need it, and we should be taking that money and investing in something that's clean and green, and above all, predictable, and that's tidal power. And we have it in abundance right on our doorstep.
It is a challenge because there's clearly it's not to the benefit of the environment to be running buses with one or two passengers on them. So it is a challenge. In terms of the environment, I mean, we should be moving towards electric cars and those cars powered by green electricity. And I agree with you that the public transport, in our Dyland Butte, where it's off the parts of our Dyland Butte that aren't connected to the rail network anyway, it
means that the buses are few and far between. But there is no easy answer to that, because even when buses are put on, you tend to find that they are usually not very well used. I think what we need to look after is elderly people who can't drive and need to get about. I think that the way forward is by supporting the various community transport schemes and expanding dial-a-bus. I think expanding dial-a-bus and community transport schemes are probably the best way forward.
I mean, I think it is an enormous challenge, and I don't think there's an easy, simple fix to it. I mean, I think that the good thing about Argyll, and we live in a really, really beautiful part of the world. We are a carbon sink, so in Argyll and we can really say in terms of our environmental credentials that we are at carbon zero already. But the challenge of that geography is what you said, sir, in terms of public transportation. And I don't think that there is an easy fix, because you've got to look at, why we take our journeys. And we take our journeys because we're going from various points to various other points, and they're not connected up by a bus network or by a train network. And I think that's the challenge. And in a rural area, I think you're always going to have that. It's much, much easier in an urban area like a city to have, undergrounds, metro rails, a really, really connected up bus transportation system that you'll never get in a rural area. I think there's probably things we could do more of, but putting on a bus from your town to wherever you're wanting to go is satisfying you necessarily, but won't satisfy probably three quarters of the whole. And I think that's a challenge. And how do you actually run that effectively and efficiently? And there's always a limit to public money. So where's the better place to put some of that public money? And I agree that potentially we need to look at infrastructure. So in terms of the electrification of vehicles, we've already got hybrid vehicles just now, which are petrol and battery. As we move to electrification, the one thing we actually do need is we do need actually charging points. And we're going to need them here in Argyll and Bute, not just for us as residents, but for the people that we want to bring into Argyll and Bute, like tourists. And I think that is the greater opportunity, because I don't think that we'll be able to get that real shift from car and private transport to public transport, because I don't think it's going to be achievable. So I think we've got to make the private transport, the car, much more green, much more friendly. And to me, that's by electrification and by having charging points across our communities. That, to me, is a much more worthwhile investment.
Can I feed into that a little bit?
Yeah.
Because I'd like you to talk about not just public transport, but school buses, which are always full of children, and they could be electrified tomorrow.
Children on the buses.
BYD in China produced 500,000 buses last year for the Chinese market. You can buy a bus off the shelf.
Yep.
School buses are full of children. They need clear air to breathe.
Yeah, I mean, I think we are starting to see that shift, because I know that there is buses I've seen in terms of that they've moved to much cleaner diesel. We've got buses that are running on hydrogen, for example, in Aberdeen. But again, there's the whole issue around the infrastructure. So in terms of electric buses, that is possible. That requires an investment by the bus companies. And potentially by having suitable charging points. But yeah, I think that's what I mean. If we can have electric cars, and we can have we can have electric buses, we've got hydrogen buses in other parts of the UK. So I think that is doable, and that's one way that we could actually electrify, as you say, the public transport system.
Yeah, it's cheaper to run as well, so you can run a service that's not so efficient, because it's actually the running costs. Significantly cheaper.
I mean, I work in the motor trade. Yeah, electric vehicles are much, much cheaper to run than normal petrol combustion or diesel engines.
And people have questions. I was just checking on that one. The revenue from petrol diesel through tax is astronomical for the government. The gain is such a lot. At the moment, electric cars are brilliant, well, brilliant in many ways, but there's no tax on electricity, so that's why they're very cheap to run. Would a government guarantee that they won't start hiking up the electricity through car use when all the petrol revenue starts increasing?
So I think what we'll do is we'll come to that question. We'll ask the first question about public transport, give the other two an opportunity, and then we'll come into that question.
Do you remember that
one? Ask it
again.
Maybe ask it again.
In terms of the buses question, that's an interesting one. I wasn't aware of that personally, and that would be something I'm in favour of, because I actually have to use the buses every day to get in and out of university. And they are dirty and smelly and just unpleasant. So it's something I would like to look into. So yeah, definitely. Was there any
It was just about creating a more efficient public transport network.
Okay, I was so focused on the buses. We've obviously never got really great policies regarding that. You know, especially with the railways as well. We're going to bring it into public ownership as well. And it was announced, I think it was today as well, that we were going to cut rail fares by 33%, which, if I've got my figures right, would save the average commuter about £1,000 roughly a year. So I am aware of that. But also as well, in terms of the buses as well, I think it was Cormac said that he was going to make sure the councils had the power to make sure you could have a joined up thinking, so you're not just left and you have to make a connection with one bus. You're going to have something, you know, you're going to make sure you have a connection, you're not standing for an hour in the rain or something like that. So it's kind of just a common sense thinking in terms of planning. So I think as well it was the rail electrification as well, and we're going to promote ultra low emission road vehicles as well. And I think that'll be through keeping the tax low on that. Thank you.
Yeah, I think we are in many ways reaping the sad legacy of the fact that the Duke of Argyll many, many, many years ago didn't fancy railways coming through his land, and therefore there's nowhere as poorer served by a railway network than Argyll. And as a result, we have to this day been playing catch up. And I think we're all aware and we've all seen the ghost buses. You know, the service going through a town at a time where nobody actually needs a bus service going through a town, but the bus goes through anyway and going to wherever it goes. And I think you have to work out what the need of the community is. You have to get the faith of that community that the bus service is going to be on time and reliable in order to build that level of trust. Because if you don't, people, if they are busy, will continue to take the convenient option, and that's to jump in their car. And that's what we're seeing. So there does have to be a huge investment in public transport, but it has to be public transport which is community led, I think, that's imposed from on top. Your question on electric cars and the zero tax rating on electric cars, I think, if I was, maybe I'm just old and cynical, but I think that's your incentive to move away from diesel and from petrol. And the minute that that's no longer an option, I'm sure the first Chancellor that needs a bit of cash in his back pocket will put exactly the same, or as near as whatever, the same tax on electric cars as it would on any other car. It's a means of funding the exchequer. And I'm quite sure the incentive will go when there is no option other than electric cars.
So the question earlier was, at the moment there's fairly good incentives for going with an electric car, like no tax, and will that be guaranteed in the future, or do you see your government, if they get in power, rescinding that? Is that about right?
Pretty well. It's the electric, there's lots of things with electric cars as well, because in the heart of Glasgow, how many people could have a hookup point from their flat down to their car, which is probably far more near. So there's a whole range of things. So we go through the moment's idea that electric cars are the only way forward, which at the moment that's what we're going for. But whether we can go for zero carbon emissions from a car, is it realistic in a town because you can't charge them all? So does thought have to go on through maybe hydrogen cars? Because that we could actually maintain in the future. If we stumble on that one in 20 years' time, then Christ, we'd better start thinking about hydrogen car now, because we can't do it.
So I have a few of the solutions actually that are floating around, but before I ask the question, do you guys have any ideas about infrastructure and how we solve the inner city problems with electric car ownership?
To answer the first question about the taxation, it is a good question. It's a question that's always raised when governments introduce taxes to persuade people to change behaviour, like taxes on smoking or on alcohol or, in this case, on cars. That if people do change behaviour, what does the Chancellor do about the lost revenue? And the answer is he will have to find, he or she, or the Chancellor of the future, will have to find some method of replacing the revenue from fuel duty. And whether that will be a tax on all cars or a tax on something else, we don't know, but some other tax will have to be raised to make up for it. In terms of the infrastructure, yes, it's a very important point that we will either have to find a way to have the infrastructure in cities. I mean, I would hope that technology could develop so that the miles that would have to be done between charging would be greatly lengthened. And obviously in a city, if somebody's just driving about a city, it's a long time at the moment between they have to fill up their tank, and it'd be a long time before they would have to be charged. But yes, it's something that's going to have to be considered. Hydrogen is another possible solution. I think I'll wait for Philip to hear what his ideas are, because I understand the problem, but I don't know the solution.
I think there's a number of different strands to your question. I mean, certainly what we tend to now see in new housing developments is you do see some of that infrastructure going in, so you do get a charging point, and I think that's fine where you've got off-street parking. I think the greater challenge is, for example, round about sort of traditional tenements. How exactly do you manage that? You can't have wires trailing, from somebody's window down. And so I think that there is an issue round about that. And even if you had, effectively pop-up technology that people would plug in, there's an issue round about potential security as well. We're going to have to find some of those solutions if we're going to move there. But I suppose I've got two primary concerns around this. One is, if we manage to do the switch over to electrification and all the vehicles on the road in the UK in the next 10 years were electric, would we have enough power supply in the UK to actually power the country as well as power the vehicles? And I think that's up for debate. And I think the other one, from an environmental point of view, is that in terms of the batteries, the battery technology for the vehicles requires lithium, which is a rare metal. And I think there's some real issues round about that. If you see growing markets for electric vehicles across the world, and let's not just think about the UK, but in terms of China, which will probably have two billion cars within the next 10, 15 years. If you start to see those all being electric vehicles, and then we're having to mine to actually get the lithium to put in the batteries, I think that there is real challenges there. That it's like most things in life. Nothing is cost free. So we move to electric vehicles, and we think, well, that's a benefit. But then we'll look at parts of the world that we've had to mine to death in terms of lithium. And we think, well, there's a real environmental cost there for those communities. So it's a very, very difficult solution to find everything that works. And in terms of hydrogen cars, we do have a couple of hydrogen cars already in the UK. But again, you know, the limiting factor is the same as electric vehicles, it's infrastructure. And you know, the government is responsible for infrastructure, and the government, both at UK and Scottish level, are going to have to step up to the mark on this. Because that's the way that we're moving.
Just on that point, do you have anything in your manifesto that you have already done to step up to the mark for electrification or for hydrogen?
I mean, I think in every manifesto there's an acceptance that we're going to have to put money in.
But I know, more specifically, do you have something that we're going to electrify X amount of...
Well, we've certainly put in a budget there to do that and made a commitment to do that. But again, it's a long-term infrastructure commitment, you know, because that's the way that it's going. So we need to accept that we're going to have electric vehicles in the next 10, 15 years. So as a party, then we need to accept that that's the reality and we need to do that.
This is the end of part one of this podcast. Please go to part two on the same article on the website.